Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Euthanasia is bad medicine and even worse public policy. Once a society accepts the principle that killing is a splendid answer to suffering, the kinds and extent of suffering that come to be seen as appropriate reasons to cause death expands continually. Often this suicide agenda, let's call it, advances so slowly that over time people become acclimated to policies that were once unthinkable. But that has not been the case in Canada, where the government and much of the population enthusiastically embraced what the law euphemistically calls medical assistance in dying, or MAID. As a result, the slippery slope can be seen slip-sliding away in real time, to the unfortunate point that in just a few years, euthanasia has become the fifth leading cause of death in Canada. Indeed, euthanasia has become so normalized there that more than 15,000 people are killed by medical professionals each year. Alex Schadenberg, who founded the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, is probably the most effective opponent of euthanasia in Canada and internationally. He's here to tell us how his country came to embrace turning doctors into intentional killers of patients. Also joining us today is Roger Foley, who has seen the cruelty of Canadian euthanasia permissiveness up close and very personal. Foley lives with cerebral ataxia, a rare genetic progressive disease that damages the nervous system, causing people with FA to lose control of their muscles over time. Because of his disability, he has been pressured on several occasions to ask for euthanasia, as if being lethally injected were a proper treatment for his condition. Foley will tell us his story. Gentlemen, welcome to Humanize.
Wesley, it's great being with you. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for having me, Wesley.
You're very welcome. Each say hello and identify yourselves so our listeners know your voices, please.
Yeah, it's Alex Schadenberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition.
My name's Roger Foley. I'm currently a patient at the London Health Sciences Centre. I'm 49 years old and I have spinal cerebellar ataxia, type 14.
Well, thank you for being with us, Roger. Alex, let's start with you. Why should people care about the legalization of euthanasia?
Well, what this issue is about, as you have outlined in your introduction, is this is about giving doctors and nurses in Canada, nurse practitioners also, the right in law to kill you. That's what it actually does. But it's not only then about killing you, it's about the acceptance that it's acceptable to be involved directly in killing another person who has possibly some sort of medical condition. And I'm going to say something very quickly. Like all countries, it started out under the basis of it would be for terminally ill people who were suffering, and it's exploded since, and it's become very much for a very large swath of people, including people with disabilities who simply have financial issues or housing issues.
Tell us about the work of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition.
Well, we've been working since 1999 to oppose euthanasia-assisted suicide, and we started in Canada. We are, in fact, working worldwide on the issue. But the fact of it is we from the very beginning said that doctors, nurse practitioners, anybody in law should never have the right to be involved with killing another person, even upon request. And we also look at the other side of it. Why is someone asking for euthanasia? Why is someone asking to be killed? And I think fundamentally, when we look at that issue and that data, you realize most people are asking to be killed based more on a social issue their loneliness. They fear for their future. They don't want to be a burden on others. These are not the same issues as someone suffering such an extreme pain, which of course could also be cared for properly rather than someone being killed.
The official term for euthanasia in Canada is MAID. I mean, it so sanitizes what's going on. How did that euphemism come to be accepted among the population and in the healthcare system?
Well, the term MAID was actually a made in Canada term because they didn't like this term euthanasia. Like the Dutch, as much as euthanasia in the Netherlands has been there for quite a few years, the Dutch are at least honest about what they do, and they're willing to use the term euthanasia. They even sometimes, when you read an article, use the term killing, and they don't seem to be too flustered by that. Whereas in Canada, euthanasia, assisted suicide, suicide, homicide, these are all terms like, no, we can't have. So they came up with this term medical aid in dying, and from the beginning, they tried to intentionally confuse it as a medical treatment being similar to palliative care. So it was all about trying to make the culture feel better about the concept of killing another person.
In a sense, it's using the authority of the doctor to justify being lethally injected, which is homicide.
It is homicide. In fact, that's how we legalized it in Canada. If you look at Canada's criminal code, we created an exception to homicide in the criminal code. So what it means is that so long as that MAID application form has two signatures on it, either, you know, it could be two doctors, two nurse practitioners, one of each. As long as there's two valid signatures on it, the doctor who or nurse practitioner goes ahead to kill you have complete legal anonymity, meaning the law says that the doctor or nurse practitioner only have to be of the opinion that you fit the criteria of the law. So there was no way that even in a controversial case that you can actually prosecute someone under this law.
You meant legal immunity, right?
Yeah, legal immunity. Absolutely. You cannot in any way go after the doctor for something they have done or the nurse practitioner.
As you mentioned, it started with supposedly terminally ill people. As I recall, the criteria was that death was reasonably foreseeable, which is a broad enough definition to drive a hearse through. And this was passed because the Supreme Court of Canada basically said that being killed by a doctor should be a constitutional right. Is that right?
Well, the Supreme Court didn't actually call it a constitutional right, but it's very similar to that. But what it was all based on the concept of suicide. The argument that they agreed to was that because suicide was not illegal, of course, suicide was not illegal because suicidal people either die or need help. Nonetheless, suicide was not illegal. Therefore, they said assisting a suicide should not be illegal. And they went through certain circumstances around that. But they didn't actually create a constitutional right. That's what the euthanasia lobby claims, but the language is not a right. Nonetheless, because it's done by doctors and nurse practitioners and it's legal, et cetera, it's now being considered a medical treatment, which is even more scary because if it's a medical treatment, doctors and nurses have to make sure you know it's available to you. You have to be, you have the right to know your legal options for medical treatment. And so this becomes one of those medical treatment options.
So it would be as if I went to my doctor with an infection and my doctor said, well, there are certain treatments we can give you. One of them would be antibiotics. But you're saying that in Canada, not only would they perhaps talk about different medicines or perhaps surgeries or whatever it might be, but they also would be telling you, or we can give you MAID.
Correct.
Which would basically, without saying, we're going to be killing you.
Well, they wouldn't do that for an infection, I'm assuming. But nonetheless, right. Yes, a MAID does become an option that way. On top of it, all major hospitals, and this is what obviously Roger's been facing, they have a MAID team. So the team goes around to not only do the act, but they're involved in promoting the act. So the concept is that, well, you have a right to know that this is available to you. So therefore, the MAID team will go and say to someone who, let's say, is in the hospital with cancer or has some sort of other medical condition, to make sure they know that, oh, did you know that, you know, we can provide MAID for you. We'll sit with you and hold your hand as we kill you. Would you like that? Now, of course, they won't use the word kill.
Right, right. We'll end your suffering kind of thing.
That's right. We will end your suffering. We will.
So, yeah. Canada started with the reasonable foreseeable standard, and then they loosened it very quickly to include people with disabilities like Roger, people who are elderly and frail, people with chronic conditions, and so forth. And they now have, the Canada law has what's called a two-track system for euthanasia. Describe the two-track system.
Okay, so in March of 2021, Canada passed Bill C-7, which removed the requirement that someone have a natural death being reasonably foreseeable, which was, as you already said, wasn't actually defined at all, but that was the terminal illness requirement. By removing that from the law, what they actually did is they opened the door then to people with chronic conditions. Because what remained in the law is, yes, you had to be 18 and you had to be suffering, etc., but you had to have an irremediable medical condition. Well, you know, people with disabilities, obviously, in the nature of a disability, have an irremediable medical condition. So the disability lobby was absolutely correct when they said you're designing a law which specifically now focuses on them. So what the law does now in its two-tier nature is, if you do have a terminal condition, you can have a same-day death.
A same-day death.
Right. But if you don't have a terminal condition, so you have an irremediable condition, such as some form of significant disability, it could even be just severe back issues, because you're not actually in any way threatened by that, but you do have a disabling condition, then you would have a 90-day waiting period. And that's how they have it right now.
And the 90 days starts from when they ask to be killed?
I'm assuming it would start from when you ask to be killed, but it could be some doctors might do it differently. But you can get approved fairly quickly, because you have to understand that as long as you find one doctor willing to do the act, that doctor will obviously know other doctors who are very pro, and they're not sending you to the anti-euthanasia doctor to get the opinion, the second opinion. They're sending you to someone who's on that MAID team. So it's the MAID teams that are involved in these sort of situations. We also have the euthanasia clinics. So, for instance, the case of Keanu in Toronto a couple years ago, Keanu is alive, but at the time he was a 23-year-old young man in Toronto who was insulin dependent. Now, he was going through suicidal ideation. He was approved to die by euthanasia at the MAID House, which is the euthanasia clinic in Toronto. MAID House has now expanded since. There's other cities that also now have a MAID House. But you can understand that was the whole decision of that MAID team at a euthanasia clinic, that yes, Keanu can be killed and we will do it.
Because he had diabetes and but it may have been his depression that he wanted to die about, right?
He was insulin dependent diabetic is how he was approved, based on having an irremediable medical condition. He's only alive today because his mother was so upset by this situation that she went to the media. She started a petition. She was very loud and she named the doctor who was planning to kill her son. And the doctor thought, maybe I'm not going to do that.
In Canada, you've got a healthcare crisis, and it may take months for somebody with cancer to get an oncologist. It sounds to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that it's easier to be killed by a doctor in Canada sometimes than to get treatment for serious conditions.
Well, that's correct. So what it is that you can have, if you have a terminal condition, now in the case you'd have to have seen an oncologist and have, I guess, that would be confirmed. But once you're confirmed that you have a terminal condition, you can have a same-day death. I'm not saying it happens every day, but there are cases. There was a recent report that came out of Ontario showing some of these same-day deaths, and some people even met the doctor in the morning for the first time and died that evening. So you start thinking about this whole concept. Treatment, you might have to wait a long time for treatment. Depending on the condition, like there was a couple of cases here in British Columbia where the guy was approved for medical treatment. He ended up dying by euthanasia, but he was approved for medical treatment. Then he had to go in the queue to wait to receive his treatment. And he waited and he waited and he waited. Well, instead he died by euthanasia because he hadn't received any treatment and he was getting worse. You've got also cases of people who were referred to an oncologist and it took them, 10 weeks or so to be able to see the oncologist. Well, by the time you've seen an oncologist after waiting 10 weeks or more, often that cancer has spread. So you get people who die by euthanasia, not because they didn't have options for treatment, but because when the time came, they didn't have options for treatment because of the waiting system.
So are people with disabilities being euthanized in Canada?
Absolutely. People with disabilities are being euthanized in Canada. Obviously, we've got Roger with us today, but I mean, and how he's been pressured, but we've had stories of people who had homelessness issues, people with poverty issues. The case that always comes out is the case of the man in St. Catharines who had subsidized housing. He had a back He had a disability, gave him serious back issues, so he was on disability benefit. And his housing, so he had a housing problem. His house that he was living in was sold to a new owner, and he was told he had to move out because they were going to, you know, do repairs, etc. But he could not find a place that he could afford to live. So he was approved for euthanasia based on his disability, but he was asking for it based on, he said, I can't be homeless. I can't have this disability and be homeless. Now, people did raise money for him.
So the disability becomes the pretext, not the cause of wanting to die.
Yeah, and that's actually very common. Like if you start reading these reports about people dying by euthanasia and then these reports coming out about it, you realize that this is very common. People with housing issues, people with poverty issues, people having a difficulty receiving medical treatment. See, a lot of people with disabilities need a regular care by the medical system. And when the system's all, you know, in a state of crisis, they are themselves then losing out and ending up choosing or quote choosing euthanasia when in fact they were pushed into this situation.
Either by actual doctor pressure or the MAID team. I want to talk about that for a quick second. Roger, we're going to get to you real quick here. Who is in the MAID team? What does it consist of? It sounds almost like a hospice team, which is totally different, which is supposed to help people live. Yeah. And in terms of their terminal condition, so the hospice team will have a doctor, will have a palliative care nurse, may have a chaplain, will have a social worker, have volunteers to help the person. In fact, I've been a hospice volunteer. It sounds like the MAID team is a similar concept, but the point is to make someone dead.
Yeah, the MAID team is all based on having a doctor or nurse practitioners who are then visiting with people who would qualify and making sure they know that they would qualify, assessing them, and then killing them. Now, the MAID teams were created for two reasons. One is they said, well, we have to make this, because it's now a legal, you know, thing in the country, we have to make it available to people. And most doctors weren't willing to do that. Most doctors said, I'm not, you know, killing people. I'm not going to do that. So by creating the MAID team, you are creating availability. It doesn't take a lot of people to kill a lot of people. So secondly, yeah. You have the group now is going to be involved with killing. But secondly, as I say, they're going around and they're selling it. So they are literally telling people, yes, you know, you can qualify for MAID. And they really sugarcoat it. I was just at an event last week and a friend of mine said that he goes to play cards all the time. And the guy he was playing cards with, his brother had just died by euthanasia. And he said, my friend told me, I can't believe this because this is something he would have never, ever considered. But what happened is he met this nurse practitioner and she convinced him that really MAID was a wonderful thing. You know, it's so easy, so wonderful. And she would be there with him and all the rest of it. So he went ahead and in the end, that's how he died. And he said, but this is crazy because it was nothing that he would have ever considered with his values. And he ended up dying this way. So it was the sales approach that convinced him.
And the elderly, frail elderly, have the same option. Is that right?
Absolutely. And the other problem is that every, you know, government-funded medical institution is being pressured to provide euthanasia. So, for instance, at this very moment, I'm in British Columbia. In British Columbia, the BC, British Columbia Health Ministry has mandated that every medical institution receiving money must provide euthanasia. It's not an option. And so even the Catholic institutions are being told they used to transfer people. They're now being forced to set up a little MAID center that's almost connected to them in order to have the killings done because MAID can be done easily. The crazy thing is you might wait, you know, a year to get your hip replacement, but you can have MAID tomorrow.
Yeah. And in Ontario, at least, doctors can be forced to participate either by killing the patient or providing what's called an effective referral, meaning they will find the doctor they know will be willing to kill. It seems to me, Alex, and you know, there's been a lot of joking in our country and our president about the 51st state and all that stuff, but any society that forces people to take innocent human life, it seems to me, isn't a free society.
Thank you. I think that's a very accurate thing to say. Then it's certainly not a free society. And there's many people who are willing to be complicit in that. The difficulty for those, as you're now talking about doctors being forced to participate in some way by referrals and things like that, is there's many physicians who want nothing to do with this. and they're finding themselves in a very bad place. So these are the type of physicians that I would want for myself. I don't want a doctor to be my caregiver who's willing to kill me. I just don't want that. I don't feel safe with that. But at the same time, if you're forcing them, you're also forcing them out of the system. Some of them are retiring already. I did a talk recently in a small community, and this one doctor after the talk came up to me and says, "Alex, I'm a doctor in this community, but I've recently shut down my practice." And he was in his early 60s. He was completely healthy. He sounded like he's completely, you know, capable. And he said, "You know, the reason was is they told me I was going to have to refer people." He says, "I was never going to refer anybody, and I don't need the money anymore. I don't need the headache. I just decided it's time to get out."
Yeah, it strikes me that in a society, and we have it here in the States as well, where you basically have a doctor shortage and there's a crisis getting access to care, driving doctors out of the profession by forcing them to kill is not the smartest policy. Yet it seems like the ideology of this matters more than common sense and practicality.
Well, that's what you get in this type of a society that believes it's okay to kill. It all becomes with this premise that it's okay to kill. Well, then if you're not willing to kill, then somehow you are now on the outside. You are now the problem. And that's what we see. But also, it's just for the Americans, we've had, and I know quite a few good physicians who have left Ontario, where I live, and have gone to the U.S. Last year, a friend of mine, I was at a Christmas party, and a friend of mine was there. He's a physician. And he says, "Alex, I just got accepted in Ohio. I'm moving to Ohio." And so now he's a physician in Ohio. And he was a good physician, a young guy with a family and the whole bit. And we've lost him because he was not in any way willing to be complicit with the killing. And he knew in Ohio he didn't have to be.
Canada was supposed to legalize euthanasia for the mentally ill, but that was delayed. What is the status of that circumstance?
So once again, we go back to Bill C-7 from March of 2021. So that bill included euthanasia for mental illness alone as a legal concept. So we're not just talking about people who have some mental health issues, but they also have significant physical issues. This is mental illness alone. That was first delayed until March of 2023, and then it was delayed again until March of 2024. Now it's delayed to March of 2027. We just had an election and re-elected a Liberal government. It's the Liberal government who has supported these policies. So I have no idea if this government is going to once again delay or they're going to implement. I do not feel good about this situation whatsoever. Euthanasia for mental illness alone is not much different than euthanasia in general, because we already have euthanasia for people with mental illness, but they have to have another health condition. What it means is that in your deepest, darkest time when you need help and you can't get psychiatric care very easily in Canada either, now euthanasia becomes an option for this way out. And remember, a lot of people with psychiatric conditions, suicidal ideation is one of the symptoms of their condition. So now killing someone by homicide becomes a treatment for suicidal ideation. And that's all of this is like, you can't make it up. It becomes more ridiculous as we go along. But nonetheless, it's part of this whole scheme of it's okay to kill.
In Canada, to be euthanized, you have to be an adult. Are there plans afoot? I've been hearing rumblings to legalize euthanasia for children.
Sadly, the answer is yes. So in February of 2023, we had a government committee report come out. So the government had set up this committee on euthanasia to look at further expansions of the law. One of the things they examined was euthanasia for mature minors. Now, our mature minor is not based on an age. It's based on someone who's under 18 who's been assessed as being capable of making or consenting to whatever sort of treatment options, etc. So a mature minor could be 12 or could be 14 or 15, depending on whether or not the doctors assess them as being competent. So that report said yes to mature minors. We should have this. So it's not been done. It's not legal in Canada. It's not happening. Nonetheless, a government committee said it should be done. And they said it based on equality. They said it was a discrimination. It was an inequality in the law to deny a mature minor euthanasia. And so that was their argument based on equality. I'll go one step further, though. The Quebec College of Physicians, which is a major force in Canada, they have called for euthanasia of newborns. So their argument is that it's inhumane to allow a newborn to suffer when they're born with a disability, so we should kill them. This is infanticide. But and you know, this is really eugenic in the most extreme sense. Nonetheless, yep. People allow these discussions to happen and just sort of act like ho hum.
And lest our listeners think, well, they would never kill babies, they already do in the Netherlands for the same reason.
Right. They have the Groningen Protocol in the Netherlands. So that's newborns or children under the age of one who could be killed by their physician if the parents ask for it. Yes.
And it sounds to me like if a mature minor asked to be euthanized, they could be killed without parental knowledge or consent in the same way, as I understand it, mature minors can now decide their own medical treatment protocols in Canada. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. So if you're determined to be a mature minor, then you're treated as if you were an adult. And so all of the medical decisions, everything, it's determined that you are capable of consenting. So there's this whole legal framework that has been decided by certain legal decisions that have defined this whole mature minor question. So it is possible, I'm not saying it would happen every day or anything, but it is possible that a 13-year-old could die by euthanasia and the parents never knew that their child was scheduled to be killed.
Until they picked up the body. Let's turn to Roger. Roger, thank you for being here. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, before my disabilities deteriorated, I paid my dues in the Canadian economy and worked my way to the Royal Bank of Canada, where I was a e-business national manager. I won many awards as a top performer and award of excellence winner. As the spinal cerebellar ataxia deteriorated, I increasingly lost my functions. Eventually, I wasn't able to work anymore, so I had to go on long term. Then my disabilities deteriorated even more, where I needed in-home support. So I was thrown into the blender of the Canadian home care system, which is really fragmented, patchy, inappropriate, and straight-up abusive. So there were many agencies that I had, and I suffered a lot of injuries. There were missed visits. There were people coming in my house that were very unprofessional. For instance, some would fall asleep in my living room while I was having a bath, and then I would call for help, and no one would answer. I'd have to crawl out of the tub soaking wet naked through my place, and all of a sudden I hear snoring, and I find a worker like asleep in my apartment. I've suffered major injuries, like major knee injuries, slammed into walls from workers rushing to do the booking in the horror lift, food poisoning, my kitchen. There was a small kitchen fire from a negligent worker. A lot of things. And that takes a toll on the mental health, as it does.
Of course it does.
Yeah. So I became very suicidal. I had a plan. It was creating what they call a suicide bag. I had been collecting bags. I knew where to get the helium. I was speaking with my social worker. Was very emotional because of the horrible treatment I was facing with the home care agency, and it accidentally came out that I had a plan. She took it very seriously. She called my family.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Good for her.
Yeah. She's a very good social worker. One of the best one I ever had. And she quickly phoned my family doctor. Then I was admitted into mental health at LHSC. LHSC brought in a home care agency. They said, oh, we're going to make everything good. It's going to improve. Don't worry. So I was discharged. 2 months later, I'm readmitted because everything fell apart again. Every promise they made, they didn't keep. So then February 2016, admitted in LHSC, the psychiatrist doctor, who was my most responsible physician said the home care agency is not safe. It's not safe to release me. So then I was admitted, and I've been in the hospital ever since, and it's been challenging.
To say the least, it would be very difficult. What kind of, what is the extent of the care you need now? Are you able to get out of bed? What is the extent of your current disability?
I'm completely bedridden. The only way I can get out of bed is via ceiling truck. I also have lost my ability to swallow. I'm on a puree diet. I have to be put in a chair where my body can go forward more than 90 degrees to do an effortful swallow. All my medications are crushed and so forth. So what my day used to involve before electricity cut out the lighting accommodations, where now I'm being starved, I'm on an IV. It's really horrible. I'm going through a lot of abuse. But before, when the lighting accommodations were in place for my eyes, because I, part of spinocerebellar ataxia is light sensitivity, so, and visual deterioration. So my eyes are very photosensitive. So I can't tolerate bright light or blue wavelength light. And it was low level amber light that was the accommodations that they cut off. But before this, I would be lifted up in the ceiling truck, placed in the chair, still hooked in the ceiling truck so it didn't fall out of the chair, because I don't have full control of my limbs.
Yes.
And so all it would be would take my food, take my meds, hydration. I do legal work and research. I try to get the home care I need, which is self-directed funding for home care, where I get to choose the workers and who comes in my home, where I build the circle of care.
It's sometimes called independent living.
Yes, yes. And in the States, they call it many things like consumer-directed care, self-determination. Many countries have individualized funding systems. Like in the UK, it's a right to have. Same thing in France. But in Canada, it's a the agencies own you like you're a piece of property. Well, you are their piece of property. And it's an iron-fisted home care approach. So I also have been doing legal work through the courts and the tribunals, and it's just been never ending. So
you know, what you want is life with dignity. And when you were suicidal, you had a really good social worker who engaged in suicide prevention. And now you're in a situation where, as I understand it, you actually have had doctors say, why don't you have MAID? In other words, pushing suicide upon you. Is that right?
Correct. And it's been multiple times by multiple different levels. Like, in the hospital, they do a lot of things, and they cut off your access to basic needs. Other, they stop your access to equipment you need to access food, meds, and water, or they end the lighting accommodations, or they flat out start to starve you, saying, oh, the food is too difficult to get up. Or so I was being starved in
20. Do you feel like you're being pushed in a particular direction?
Of course. It's all coercion in the Canadian healthcare system. Before MAID, it was coercion to like long-term care or some bad outcome that they want. It's torture tactics. They do this so that you make agreements under duress that you would never make if you were allowed to of your free consent. Let me
ask you a question. Mm-hmm. Describe one of the conversations. You said this has happened to you repeatedly where they brought up MAID.
Yeah.
kind of take us through the get back and forth, if you will. You know, I'm not asking for exact quotes, but substantively, what the doctor or whoever was mentioning it to you said and how you responded.
The first suggestion actually came from a floor coordinator. I was food was very far and few between. I was occasionally being starved, and on this day I didn't have any food, and food was scarce, and I was advocating for food to be sent up so that I could eat.
So you were asking to be fed?
Yeah, and so the coordinator, really abusive person, like she came in my room and berated me, and I told her, when you do things like this to me, when you and your staff berate me, cut off access to food and basic needs, that makes me very suicidal. And she just looked at me with a cold stare and said, the hospital has a program to help you if you want to end your life. And like that just flicked a switch in me.
Rather than saying, oh my gosh, let's make sure we are able to provide the kind of intervention so you won't want to commit suicide, instead this floor coordinator said, oh, we can make that happen. Is that right?
Yeah, we have a program that can help you if you want to end your life. And I asked her, after being shot and staring off to the side of my bed, I turned back at her and I asked her, do you realize what you're saying to me? And she just stared at me with that same cold stare, smiled a bit and tilted her head. And then she said, you're not getting any food, and walked out the room. And
I don't understand why that you wouldn't get food. That doesn't make any sense to me.
It's ridiculous. And like later on, like a year later, the food accommodations were provided to me. So what she was denying me was nonsense. They always could provide me with the food I needed. So that flipped a switch when you say that to a suicidal person who's under duress and facing cruel punishment. All of a sudden you think, it's my only way out. Like there's no more light at the end of the tunnel to get the home care you need. All of a sudden it's this other light that's more direct, and you're like, that's a quicker way out of this hell. And they're telling me to take it. So I applied for it.
Did you?
Yeah, I sent in a written request. It took a while, but I eventually got an appointment arranged. I was hooked on that whole spiel that they have here, dying with dignity, and it's about choice and blah blah blah, like it hooks people that are under duress and facing abuse, and there's no hope. And
would it be accurate to say that when they do that, making yourself dead becomes a purpose that gives your life a certain sense of meaning when you could have received that same sense of meaning and purpose by having proper support?
Maybe for some it becomes that. I've seen other cases where that's the case, where they're, but for me it was more a way out, like get out of this horrible situation that is inescapable in a system that's very Kafkaesque. And so like the appointment was being set, and in August of 2017, at the beginning of August, that's where the referral was set and appointment was going to happen. But then I started to snap out of it. I became more focused on home care, and people close to me that I love in my family. And I decided I'm gonna fight for home care.
And how long ago was that?
That was in 2017. So
all of this time, and it's now 2025.
Yeah.
You've been fighting to get home care.
Yeah.
And during this time, has anyone else suggested to you that instead you accept euthanasia?
Yes. So when I said I want to cancel this appointment, I'm going full steam ahead to get direct funding home care, and I'm going to apply to the Health Services Review Appeal Board. The hospital admins didn't like that. So I didn't know, but behind the scenes, the director of mental health, the ethicist, and the site chief doctor organized this forced discharge. So it's like they
were going to discharge you to where?
Well, that's the thing. They came into my room. I was surrounded by them, and they gave me three choices, which weren't really choices. And like the home care they offered was less hours, and with the agencies that harmed me, then it was remain in the hospital but be charged $1,500 a day. Or they just came by to see if I was interested in assisted dying. So,
well, I thought in Canada you had free healthcare. How could they charge you $1,500 a day?
In Canada, if they deem that they made a plan that they can fit you into, be it long-term care or home care, if they created some invention of what they think is so-called safe for you to be discharged, then they cancel your insurance and charge you a per diem day if you don't consent under duress. And it's not consent.
So the choices you had was going back to the same old agency that made you suicidal in the first place with even fewer hours, which meant you would have been on your own for some period of time. Is that right?
I wouldn't have survived that. That was,
right. That's what I mean.
Yeah, I would have been deceased in maybe a couple of days. I would have been neglected, dehydrated.
Because you can't take care of yourself physically if no one's there. Is that right?
Correct. I need personal attendance,
And there would have been times when you would have been by yourself under that plan. Is that right?
I would have been abandoned a lot. I would have not been able to access food, meds, or water, or anything in my own home. Nothing. So
and the second option was $1,500 a day, which, of course, you can't afford.
Correct.
And the third option is we'll kill you.
Yeah.
Well, that just pushes you in a particular direction, doesn't it? It's either die slowly of neglect, not be able to pay something, or be killed quickly.
Correct.
That seems as cruel as I can imagine.
It is cruel. And it's in Canada, duress is supposed to be a crime, but in the healthcare system, they use duress all the time, duress and coercion and undue influence. So it's like, after that, like, you can imagine my mental state. I was destroyed, and they had me thinking about it again. But then I came to my senses, and I was like, no, don't bring this up to me. But sure enough, like, months later, they did. And then months later after that, they did again. And it'd be really creepy. It's like they do these so-called safety checks. So they come around and they say, oh, how you doing, Roger? You having any thoughts of self-harm or wanting to end your life? And it's like, as a patient, you're honest because you want help. So I was honest and I was like, yeah, like, but if I had self-directed funding, I'd be fine. And next thing you know, he was out. Well, if you don't get self-directed funding, you could just apply for an assisted. You know what I mean? And at this point, I didn't trust anyone in the hospital, and I was audio recording. So I just happened to get this one on tape. There were a few others as well. So it's like I've seen the pure evil of the regime up close many times. And you spoke about recently foreseeable with Alex in track one and track two. Well, that's a mirage, because when MAID became legal, recently foreseeable had no definition, and it quickly expanded from a month to a half a year to a year to 2 years to 10 years before death. And when I was in the hospital, a woman in Ottawa with cerebellar ataxia, less progressive than mine, she was deemed recently foreseeable, and the Ottawa Citizen made a big romantic article about her getting MAID. And that put a target on me, because when they classify these diseases as recently foreseeable and promoted as such, then I have cerebellar ataxia. So that put a target on me. This woman in the Ottawa Citizen who's recently foreseeable and had MAID. Roger has cerebellar ataxia, so hey, MAID is option for him. So
and so, because you could be deemed track one, if you went into a deep funk and asked to be killed, you could be dispatched before you were able to recover and regain the sense of wanting to live. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. And also, there's a short track too recently foreseeable, where someone doesn't eat or drink for a certain amount of days, all of a sudden they're on the trajectory towards death. So you talk about the track one and track two nowadays, the non-recently foreseeable track, if it's not happening fast enough and they don't want to wait the 90 days, they stop eating, and in maybe a week, they're in track one, because they're recently foreseeable. So,
in euthanasia parlance, that's called VSED, voluntary stop eating and drinking, and it is being promoted here in the States as well as a way to qualify for euthanasia or assisted suicide. If you're not qualified, stop eating for a week, and then a doctor will say, yes, you are, and you will be dead. Have you brought any lawsuits or anything of this kind to try, or reported this to an ombudsman to try to improve your care and to tell them to quit asking you whether you want to die?
Yes, I have many times, and I've escalated up to the UN Special Rapporteur. I filed a lawsuit in the courts. Unfortunately, I had a lawyer that drafted a defective statement of claims and didn't disclose that to me, so it was stricken. So now I'm in the Court of Appeal, self-representing, trying to get the right to file a fresh claim. I also am currently engaged in the Human Rights Tribunal about what the hospital was doing to me lately. And the hospital occasionally goes on these spurts where they start asking me suicide questions again. And I keep on telling them, no, I'm not going to answer. I don't trust you.
When was the last time you were asked whether you wanted to be killed?
Well, they do it a really sneaky way, where first they ask you suicide questions, and then they fit that in. So every time they start asking me suicide questions, I shut them off right away. I'm not going to answer.
Because you know what's coming, right?
Yeah, I know. And they were pressuring me the last couple of months with it. And I kept on telling the hospital, do not ask me suicide questions, because I know where it leads. And they don't care. And they flat out say, oh, we're going to ask you. So I keep escalating and escalating. So
So the media, as you said, with the woman who had your condition and received euthanasia, made it a big puff, wonderful story. Has the media reported your story extensively? Because it seems to me this is a clear abuse of any kind of compassionate claim in terms of this, the system.
At the beginning, CTV National News was covering me. They stopped though a long time ago in about 2018. CBC, they do more glamorous made stories. Like, they're not really interested in covering abuses at all.
Yeah.
The media here is a very tight-lipped on abuses. Occasionally, things get by, but it's more the international media that are reporting the Canadian abuse stories. It's very difficult to find reporters interested in reporting the truth about the maid regime, and also the how and why it started, like the Carter case. The judge, Lynn Smith, her daughter was working for and with the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association and Joe Arvey, the lead lawyer for Carter. And that's a clear conflict of interest.
The Carter case is the Supreme Court case that we discussed earlier where assisted suicide was made an exception. Is that right, Alex?
Yes, the Carter case was the original court case out of British Columbia that went to the Supreme Court of Canada. And Roger's absolutely correct that there was a clear conflict of interest. And Justice Smith really wanted the case. And this is how it all came together, where it ends up on her docket, because this is something that she really wanted to do. And so she got the ability to do it by getting it on her docket and then having this interconnection.
So, Alex, are there other stories like Roger's that you know about?
Well, there's been a difficulty because some of the stories that are somewhat similar to Roger's have resulted in actual death. So, you know, you have a difficulty when someone dies by euthanasia that when the story is being told outside of that, you realize that there's clear problems. But recently in October, the Ontario coroner's office put out a report of euthanasia deaths in Ontario. So Ontario has about 40% of Canada's population. And they looked at the euthanasia deaths between 2018 and 2023. And they said that there was a huge number of non-compliant deaths. So they listed this 428 non-compliant deaths. In that, they actually reported on six stories, which were ones that they thought were representative of these non-compliant deaths. So you do see other stories in there, but these are all people who have died. So when you look at this report, you're realizing these are people who had died by euthanasia, and the coroner is saying there was a problem here. This is clearly non-compliant. One of the cases, the person had no medical diagnosis.
By non-compliant, you mean it violated the law?
Violated the law in a sense, but certainly violated their outlined rules that they have. Violated the law is very difficult to do. In the case that I'm going to refer to very quickly, obviously it was a clear violation of the law because this person had no medical treatment issues whatsoever. This person had pain and symptoms after receiving their third COVID shot, and they went to doctors. So I'm not getting into the COVID issue, but I'm telling you this is the coroner's report saying. So they found no medical problems with this person. There was no diagnosis for this person. This person did have some psychiatric issues, etc. Nonetheless, this person was experiencing symptoms and pain related to sort of like a fibromyalgia type condition and died by euthanasia, was approved and was killed. And then they did an autopsy and they found nothing wrong with this person. There was nothing in the autopsy they could identify as being any medical condition whatsoever. So you have no diagnosis and in the autopsy, no medical condition, but nonetheless, this person is dead.
So these non-compliant deaths, shouldn't there be a referral to law enforcement to bring actions because they violated apparently the euthanasia laws of Canada, which are already very loose?
So it's very difficult to refer something to law enforcement. I'm not saying it shouldn't be done because, in fact, an investigation is very important. So In British Columbia, for instance, you had the situation of Donna Duncan's death, and that was referred to law enforcement. And law enforcement did take it seriously, but in the end, they came out and said that that no law was broken. In the case of Donna Duncan, she was a woman who had had a car accident and had a, you know, she had a, what do you call it? Not a head injury, but, you know, she, we have a lot of pain and suffering, headaches really bad, etc. Anyway, Donna Duncan died by euthanasia.
Migraines.
And her family was very, very angry about it because she didn't receive any treatment for her concussion. She had received no treatment for her concussion, etc. Nonetheless, the police said that there was nothing that had been done that was wrong. And one of the reasons is exactly how Roger was referring to how the law is defined. The original law said that your natural death had to be reasonably foreseeable, but that wasn't defined. But the law also says that the doctor or nurse practitioner who approve your death and then who do your death only have to be of the opinion that you fit the criteria of the law. So obviously speaking, in this case I'm referring to was a non-compliant death in Ontario. This person had no medical condition, nothing they could identify. So I'm not saying this person did have pain and issues. I'm just saying there was nothing they could identify. But of course, the doctor who was involved in it, who did the act, was under the opinion that this person fit the criteria of the law and was therefore legally covered. Now, there were a couple cases sent to the College of Physicians, but there was only one actual punishment came from the college. And the one punishment was one of the most egregious cases in Ontario. Anybody else would say that this person should have their medical license pulled, but the Ontario College did not pull this person's medical license. What they did is they said, you can't do MAID anymore. So this person's been barred from doing MAID.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm a little stunned at all this. And for the United States listeners, one of the reasons I think Canada is so important to us here, even though we've not gone as far as Canada has, is Canada is our closest cultural cousin. And if the Canadian people can fall for this, so can we. So Alex, euthanasia remains very popular in Canada. And despite cases like Rogers and some of these non-compliant issues, why do you think that is?
I think it's been sold to the culture about freedom and choice and autonomy in such a way that people actually bought it hook, line, and sinker. But it was always a lie. It was never about freedom. It was never about choice. It was never about autonomy. It was about killing. That's correct. But it was never about these other things. So you have a situation where also people are in fear. They fear a bad death. They fear. But on top of it, you have a lot of loneliness in the culture today, more than ever before. A lot of abandonment, people feeling their life is lacking a meaning and purpose and value. They're going through a difficult health condition. You know, you just have this sort of buy-in that's happened. And it was sold to the culture through multiple stories in the media of people dying by euthanasia. Like Roger talking about the woman in Ottawa, who they made this into some beautiful death that she had, when in fact she was really abandoned, is really what happened. This is the kind of thing you've had. You've had like a brainwashing that's occurred.
Roger, you're in the middle of this. I'm really sorry you're going through what you're experiencing. What lessons can our listeners learn from your experience and from what's happened in Canada overall, do you think?
In the United States, I have been following what's been happening there, and it seems like the America with Disability Act is saving the disabled population from euthanasia and what's happening in Canada for now. But the pro-suicide groups are obsessive about one day subverting the ADA. And in the States, it's important to realize that it's not romantic. It's not a choice. It's a false choice. It will be abused and expanded, and your population will be desensitized, and ableism will grow tremendously. It's really important too, because a lot of states are now opening the door to assisted suicide, and that's very dangerous, because once assisted suicide is legalized in a state, then the push for euthanasia comes.
Right. The United States has not fallen off the cliff as far as Canada has, but if we ever as a population embrace the death agenda the way the Canadians have, the same thing will happen here. And of course, we're out of time, so I'd like to check back in with you later, Roger, to see how things are going. But part of this is also going to be about money. I mean, I've already seen stories in the Canadian press about the millions and millions of dollars that euthanasia can save for the healthcare system that is under a lot of stress. And the American and other countries' health systems are under stress too.
Also, Roger, organs as well. Organ donation in Canada has fallen off a cliff where now the very ethicist at my hospital, HSC, his name is Robert Sebald. He's advocating for the dead donor rule to be voided so they can do euthanasia by way of organ donation. So the way they kill the patient is they wheel them in, put them under, and remove their heart, all the organs they couldn't do on regular death or euthanasia, and their mode of death is taking away their organs. So,
yes, for listeners who might think that's crackers, I have reported on this in my own writing from bioethics literature, where people have said, well, you know, the quote experts, close quote, if we're going to kill them and then take their organs, which happens in Canada, the Netherlands, and Belgium, why not just take their organs as the means of euthanasia, because that will preserve the organs better for the recipient of those quote unquote donations. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank you, Roger. We will check back with you in coming months. And Alex, thank you for your work and for both of you for being with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Wesley. And I really think that Roger's story really pulls together the plight of people with disabilities when we've legalized euthanasia in Canada.
Yeah, and it illustrates why some of the most adamant opponents of assisted suicide and euthanasia are the disability rights activists, because they say, look, it's our people who are in the target, and they're absolutely right. Well, thank you both very much. Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.